The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
David ass pumpkins.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
Sometimes a soldier falls on his own sword. In 3 years' time, you will be happy again. Look to your children. Dala.
Hey, hello, everybody.
What's up?
It's Recotopia, episode 51. Today's big recommend is going to be Eve's Bayou. I'm Chris Atkinson.
I'm Jeremy Scott.
And welcome all of you who are in the chat today on Twitch and YouTube, commenting and watching us live on a Tuesday. How are you doing today, Jeremy?
I'm doing well. We are recording today with a live audience. And while we are recording, I believe James Gunn is going to announce his DC slate.
Yeah.
And I won't mind if somebody in the chat wants to tell me what that is, because I'm very excited to see what he announces. I think there are some characters that we haven't seen in a long time or at all on film that he is going to put into films. And so, everybody, I don't blame you if you are double screening it today. But we thank you for joining us as always. Your presence makes the show extra fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any small recommends, Jeremy?
I got some smalls.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
We've talked about this movie on a different podcast we used to do. Alpha Dog is running again on one of the movie channels. One of my favorite things about Alpha Dog is it never goes off the movie channels for more than a year or two. And somebody always is carrying it. And it's a great, for me, now that I've seen it so many times, it's a great background movie because there's so many beats that I love, moments that I just love watching, but I don't have to necessarily tune into the whole thing. This is based on a true story about an idiot 20-year-old drug dealer who is owed money by another idiot 20-something-year-old drug dealer and decides to kidnap his 15-year-old brother. And once he realizes a few days into it that this is going to end badly for him, well, he decides to order this kid to be killed. And there's a lot of great actors in this movie. Emil Hirsch, Anton Yelchin, Bruce Willis, Sharon Stone, Ben Foster. I'm forgetting people already. Olivia.
Yeah.
Wild, Justin Timberlake, just a huge ass cast. It's so much based on a true story. It was sued. The lawyer for the real guy, Emil Hirsch is playing, sued to have the film shut down. And they were filming. One of the conflicts, interestingly enough, was they were filming before they actually caught him in real life. And the DA had cooperated with the film, giving him all kinds of stuff from the case. And then he had a conflict of interest once they caught him, so he couldn't prosecute him, and they had to get another DA. Anyway, I think it's great. It's like a 52 on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't understand that.
Now, I think if this movie came out now, I think that would be a little bit higher. I think back in 2005, I believe, is when this, or 2006, when this movie came out, I don't know. There was something about it that wasn't connecting, but I think it would connect now.
Yeah, I find it riveting. Maybe more so. I mean, it opens with this cover of that Wizard of Oz song, Over the Rainbow. It's really slow and moody, and it's pictures of baby Anton Yelchin. And it breaks my heart every time. that he's not with us anymore.
Yeah.
Because he was such a gifted performer and he died in such a stupid, pointless way.
Yeah.
Anyway, my small recommend is Alpha Dog. Let me tell you which movie channel it's on. I don't know. It's on one of the movie channels. That's helpful. What is one of your small recommends?
This might end up being both of my recommends, since there's three movies. Actually, it'd be a total of three movies in this one recommend here. But back in the 90s, a Polish director by the name of Krzysztof Kieślowski, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, came out with the Three Colors trilogy. It's there was a movie called Blue, another one called White, and another called Red.
I remember these.
So these are all about an hour and a half each. You can watch all of these individually and enjoy them without having to have seen the other. However, Red has a particularly satisfying ending if you've seen the full trilogy. And that's the only thing I can think of. Like, if you watched Red by itself, you might be like, what's the big deal with this ending or whatever. But, to summarize, where we're on these movies here, Blue stars Juliette Binoche. I was sitting there thinking, God, how many movies have I seen where at the very beginning somebody gets in a car wreck and it kills their family?
Oh no, not again.
I've seen this so many times in the past few months. You think that I'm like somehow drawn to it in a way. But that's exactly what happens at the beginning of this movie. Juliette Binoche is with her husband and her daughter. And there's a car crash, and Juliette Binoche is the only one who survives it. And on to the funeral, and it looks like she isn't really sad about what happened. I mean, she's upset about her daughter, but when it comes to her husband, who was a composer, a well-known composer, she doesn't seem to care that much about it. In fact, it's downright just like anytime his name comes up, seems like it rattles her a little bit, and there's more anger there than sadness. And there's a moment at the where she goes to an archive of some sort where there's an unfinished composition waiting in the waiting there, and the one of the people who are taking care of it is like, oh, this looks like a beautiful masterpiece or whatever. And she's like, sure does. And she takes this blueprint of whatever this composition is and destroys it immediately. And she sells off everything in the house. She doesn't want to have anything to do with any of this stuff. She even calls somebody that works closely with the family. And she's like, do you love me? And the guy's like, yes, I love you. I've always loved you or whatever. And he comes over, they have sex. She gets up afterwards and goes, I'm going to leave now. I'm not special. You're going to forget all about this when I leave. And so she leaves, and that guy's like, but I'm in love with you and blah, blah, blah. So from there, basically the question is, does this woman ever experience happiness again? Is sort of what we get to, in this movie. She's by herself. She seems to be just in a funk the entire time. And doesn't seem like there's any hope for humanity. Will there be hope for her in the end? That's basically what it comes down to in this movie. White stars Julie Delpy. Now, Julie Delpy is not in it as often as you might think from somebody who is a first build star on this movie. It's actually a woman who plays her husband. And there's a court case at the very beginning of it. It's a divorce court case where this man who's from Poland has married Julie Delpy, and they're getting a divorce because they've never consummated the marriage. And from what we understand, Julie Delpy really wanted to consummate that marriage, but he couldn't for some reason. And so he loses everything in this divorce case. Ends up with just a suitcase basically. And he's like playing, he's playing a comb as an instrument or something in the subways of Paris. He is encountered by a man, who is also from Poland, who gives him who tells him, I could give you, I know somebody back in our homeland who says, if you kill him, he will give you all this money that would last you for 6 months. He's got a family, but he doesn't want to be part of this world anymore, basically, or something like that. And our main guy's like, I don't know how I'm going to be able to go back to our homeland. I don't have my passport anymore and all that. But he concocts a plan to put himself inside the giant suitcase that he's left with and somehow get ported through the airport terminal in the suitcase. So he's going through baggage. Now this is the 90s. Maybe they didn't check bags back in the day. he is able to get back to Poland this way. But there is one issue. People at the airport stole, there's some people who work for the airport or the airline who stole the suitcase that he's in, and they've taken him out into the middle of somewhere in Poland, and like they're expecting to get this huge bounty out of it. And they open up the case and just find this dude in there. Nothing, no money to be gained. They beat him up, and then they move on their way. But he's so happy. He's back in his homeland. He doesn't care that he got beat up. He's even close to where he lives. It's amazing. And so he goes to his brother who works at a barber shop. The brother's like, I'll let you stay here as long as you cut some heads every week. And he's like, okay, cool. And then he gets a job as a security guard. And as a security guard, he finds out this plot to buy all of this this farmland that is going to make these two people very rich, and he decides to buy very key properties in this section of land that they're talking about. He's got a bunch of money saved in Poland. I don't remember how he has all this money saved, but he's able to buy this land with it. And because he buys these little key properties, the people who want to buy this land for cheap have to go through him to get to some the stuff. So he's basically just building up a crazy empire, and he wants to get Julie Delpy back, and he's trying to call her the whole through the movie. He's trying to get her back, and she's just hangs up the phone and doesn't want to have anything to do with her, but he has a plot to bring her back. I won't spoil what happens with that, but that's the basic premise of White. And then Red, which is the classic of this. I mean, both the Blue and White are great movies. Red is the masterpiece of the group. It follows a model who is doing some sort of photo shoot for like a gum commercial, one of those billboard ads. She's driving home and she hits a dog. And she gets out and sees the dog that's hurt. And she's like, oh, I'm going to have to take care of this dog. And she actually finds out who the owner is, goes to the owner and says, I think I found your dog. I hit him and I need to take him to a vet. And the guy doesn't seem really concerned about the dog really at all. He's just like, okay, yeah, it's probably what you need to do then. She takes him to the vet. Vet takes care of the dog. Dog's going to even have puppies. It's a happy thing. So she takes care of the dog for a while. Then she goes back to that guy and says, here's your dog back or whatever. He's paid her money to take the dog to the vet. He pays too much money. So that's why she goes back to him and says, hey, I want to give you back some of this money. You paid too much. She finds out through all of this that he's eavesdropping on his neighbors. He's got this elaborate system to overhear people's phone calls, and she's like, that's messed up, you shouldn't do that type of thing. And he goes, you know what, I want you to go over to my neighbor right now and tell him that people are overhearing his calls and that I'm the one who's doing it. It's not going to matter one way or the other. And it's the scandalous thing that's happening with his neighbor is that he's married and yet he's having an affair with another man, and he's having a phone call with this man, and they're having this very explicit conversation over the phone. She goes over to the house, finds out that the uh, The wife is obviously clueless, but his daughter is sitting there listening on the other end of the line during the whole thing. So his daughter knows, and she decides not to tell them. And she comes back and says, "I didn't tell them," because he goes, "It doesn't matter. Eventually someone's going to find this out anyway." And, and so it's a very mysterious type of thing. This one, Red will take a lot to get into. There's a lot of connections between her character, and there's this side character that they keep showing, a would-be judge. They keep going back and forth between the two. They live in close proximity, and it's basically one of those movies where a decision that she makes affects that person in some very weird and strange ways. And this is one of these movies where just like every decision matters in some way. And every little thing that every little character we've seen is connected in some way. Hmm. And so every decision that is made in this movie affects one or the other. And it's really fun. It's a really great movie. It's pretty much hardcore drama, but it's a fun movie to watch because there's so much in the way of connecting these characters. And of course, by the end of it, there is a full-on connection with all three movies. And some great stuff. It feels weird discovering movies, you know, 30 years after they've come out and telling everybody, "Hey, I found these movies. Have you ever heard of these movies that like apparently critics fawned over back in the day?" I pass that along to you guys. Hopefully you guys will watch.
I've never seen any of these, I don't think. Mm-hmm. I remember them. I remember reading about them and hearing about them, and they just were always at the periphery of what I was watching. Mm-hmm. But they will bump up my list now because your recommends are usually good.
And Castro says, "What exactly is the through line for these three movies?" Well, I can't tell you that.
Yeah, that would be spoilers.
There is a connection between Blue and White very early on that I could tell you about, because in Blue, Juliette Binoche walks in on some sort of court case and she's kicked out. We don't know what the court case is, but in White, that just so happens to be the court case in the beginning, the divorce court case.
Hmm.
So she does walk in on that at the very beginning. And there's also a thing that each movie follows where it shows this old lady going to like a recycling kiosk or whatever and having a very hard time pushing a glass bottle into it. And each movie follows this, has a scene where this woman shows up and tries to push the bottle into the recycling thing. So there's like little minor ones, but Red ends with a major one. And it's one of those where it's like, I am so happy that I watched the other two movies before I watched this. These are really good. They're all short. I mean, of course it would take you roughly 5 hours to watch all three, but if you took them one at a time, each one's an hour and a half. So,
All right. Very good. I think that was good enough, long enough, sustenance enough that we should probably just move into the main recommend instead of dealing with the smalls.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The big recommend is 1997's Eve's Bayou, directed by Casey Lemons. And this is a movie that I think it passed me by back in 1997, and I can't remember if my theater that I was working at the time had this movie or what. I ended up finding this movie later in life, it's one of those that I think has just sort of somehow it's gone under the radar, And I'm glad to kind of like put it back in the spotlight today, at least a small spotlight that we can put on it. East Bayou stars Samuel L. Jackson, and it stars Lynn Whitfield as the main adult stars, but it's really Journey Smollett and Megan Good's movie. Who play their daughters. And for the most part, this movie's kind of episodic. There's not a lot, there's not like a big, huge plot line that's going through this. It's sort of a coming of age, type movie. But it starts off, you know, we find out that Eve's Bayou is named after a slave who helped a soldier back in the day. The soldier bestowed a bunch of land to her and then had 16 kids with her or something like that.
So casually thrown in there.
Yeah, exactly. And so this, the slave's name was Eve. And it just so happens that Journey Smollett's character is named Eve in this as well. They are a wealthy family, probably some years of inheritance has come down, but he's a doctor. Samuel L. Jackson's a doctor. And Lynn Whitfield is, I believe she's just a housewife. I don't want to reduce that at all. She's a housewife. They're having this big party at the beginning where it sets up a lot of different characters. Moreau. Yeah, there's a woman and her husband, Maddie Moreau and Lenny Moreau, who are dancing, and everybody's like talking about this Maddie Moreau because she seems to be getting around, and they're all talking about it. He's not the only one that's been getting with her and blah, 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 and all that. And during this party, we see that, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, he's sort of the life of the party. He even dances with Maddie Moreau, but it didn't look like there's anything going on there. But Lenny seems to think there might be. He's a little concerned that there's something going on there. And we're not really sure. It looks like, why would Samuel L. Jackson be cheating on his wife? Lynn Whitfield is gorgeous and all that. There's a point where Eve runs out to it's a garage, boathouse, something. I don't know what it is. It's another extension of the house somewhere, and hides out because he's danced with her older sister, and she's upset that she doesn't get a dance, and she hides out and falls asleep, but she is awakened to her dad, Luis Batiste, and this woman, this Moreau woman, having sex, and she is upset about what she sees. Her dad obviously is like, okay, we're gonna have to figure out a way around this one. And sort of, there's a kind of a gaslighting kind of thing that goes on there, where it was like, there's nothing really going on. And even her older sister ends up saying, oh, what you really saw, which isn't a really great scene too, by the way, when they show what she really saw.
Yeah,
because they're both in that garage together looking at it, and so what you really saw was that this awful person, this awful Maddie Moreau, came in, and you saw something where, like, our dad was a knight in shining armor the whole time, and she was trying to throw herself at him, and that, you know, was nothing really there that actually happened that our dad can be, can be accused of there. So there's no big deal with that, really. There's nothing really. It's like, we're just led to believe at this point that Luis Batiste is kind of getting around. We know this at this point because he goes around town. He's treating these women, and he stays at these women's houses, and they have these phantom kind of problems that he has to end up closing the door on his little girl who's following him around one day and says, go out and play. And so he's getting around. His main squeeze in all this is Maddie, though. He keeps on finding ways to see Maddie, but he's seeing everybody. And it's getting to the point where he barely even comes home anymore. So it's a lot of this, it's a lot of these little details, these little sort of vignettes or whatever. There's a point where they go and see a fortune teller played by Diane Carroll, who tells them that the kids are in danger, and he doesn't want to get hit by a bus. So basically they keep them in the house for the whole summer, because they don't want them to get hit by a bus. And then finally someone else's kid gets hit by a bus, and that's when it's okay to go outside. It's really fucked up.
It is. Only the grandma notices. She's like, we shouldn't be celebrating that somebody's kid died.
Yeah, exactly. Luis Batiste's sister, Moselle, is also a fortune teller. She calls herself a medium therapist or something like that. But she apparently has been able to tell the future in the past. She has had visions of the actual future. She has this weird curse where she has been married 3 times and her husbands have died all 3 times, and nothing that she's done that she knows of anyway. But the very beginning of this movie has one of her husbands taken the passenger seat while he's super drunk, and she drives him home. And in a weird sequence that I don't know if you realize, if you don't have the subtitles on, you may not even know that dude died in the car crash until a little bit later, when you see Eve at the gravesite putting flowers on his grave or whatever. It's like, I didn't catch that dude's name in the middle of all that vision and everything. Debbie Morgan plays Moselle, and I love her. She sort of really stood out to me in this cast. I really, really liked her in this. That a lot of people think that she's crazy, but she's obviously got some sort of sight, because she kind of has, she kind of knows what's going to happen with a lot of these people. And she has maybe one of the best scenes of the movie, the way it's shot and everything, when she talks about her husband and how she was cheating on her husband with another man. This man comes in to claim her, essentially, from her husband, says, I'm in love with her and I'm going to take her away. But her husband doesn't matter what she's done, says, you're going to have to kill me then. This is all done in a mirror shot that goes all the way. It's really well done.
She walks, she's in the live shot, and the two men are in the mirror shot. And then she walks to our left out of the live shot and enters the mirror shot to join the men.
Yes.
I wrote 2 or 3 different notes about how incredible this whole scene was.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. It's something that I don't feel like it ever gets talked about. And it's a great moment in cinema, I believe. To watch how this story unfolds and how it ends and everything. She also ends up falling in love with Vondi Curtis Hall, who you may recognize from Die Hard 2, movies such as Die Hard 2. but Vondi Curtis Hall plays Julian Gray Raven, who is a man who his wife left him, and he's looking for her, Moselle tells him that she's never going to come back. And there's a great moment where he goes, I need to find my wife. I need to leave you and find my wife. And she goes, but she ain't ever going to come back. He goes, I need to find my wife so I can divorce her, and then I can get with you. there is a point where, Megan Good playing Cicely Batiste, has a bunch of stuff that happens to her where we don't know what's going on. She has left. There's a point during the lockdown, during that don't want my kids to get hit by a bus lockdown, that she leaves to go see her dad in the office or whatever. She comes back. Nobody knew where she was. She comes back and her hair is all different. And she is, she's obviously been through some trauma of some sort. there's the onset of her first period. She does not want her doctor dad looking at her for this. There's something to, and we think, well, maybe it's because, maybe it's because it's her dad, and you know, you don't want your dad knowing about this type of stuff, and so whatever. But then she tells the story to her sister that she went down to comfort him after a big argument with his wife, and that he tried to be with her in that moment. It becomes a moment that is probably going to have the biggest debate that you're going to have about this movie by the end of it, because by the end of it, when Luis has died, of course, there's a great amount of like little things that I don't know where to start on all this, because I keep going, wanting to jump forward and backward and everything. I'll get to the other stuff in a minute, but when he dies, he leaves a note to his sister saying, I did not do this. She tried to come at me like she was a grown woman, of course, not my daughter. And so the movie ends with a debate, basically, because Cicely doesn't even seem to know what happened by the end of it, or doesn't know how to rectify what the truth was. Moving back into how he dies, there's a really interesting sequence of events where it also sets up another debate for you as well. Does Eve kill her father because of what she says to the Lenny Moreau guy? Or does she kill her father because there's actual voodoo involved?
Oh, man, I wrote down she kills her father long before she ever got to the voodoo lady. She killed him by willingly telling her father's side piece's husband about the affair.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's a point where she says, she makes this big, like, weird connection, like my mom's a homebody, she's lonely or whatever, and you're that kind of guy, but my dad is not, and your wife is not, and sort of puts this two and two together type of thing in his head without even saying, hey, I think that they're having an affair. She puts that seed in his head, but she also goes over to the Diane Carroll medium and says, I want to do this voodoo thing. And she thinks she does it wrong. There's this idea that maybe the voodoo could be a possibility, but at least in her head, she may not even think that what she said, that's a very big possibility. The movie's just saying in her head, in her mind, the voodoo is just as strong as her saying what she did to the husband. But she goes in and tries to, she goes to her dad, who's in a bar with this Moreau lady, and she wants to drag him home. And if he would just go home right then, maybe there wouldn't be a problem. But Lenny shows up ready to kill him if he does the wrong thing. And what this opening argument in the movie foreshadowed, where he and the other guy went back and forth and they went in the big drunken fight and everything, yep, is that Luis never backs down ever like quits. There's never a moment where I need to stop talking. Lenny says, if you say one more word to my wife, I'm going to kill you. And he has taken like that line, like, you know, I'm not going to kill you because of what you've done. I'm going to kill you from this point forward if you do anything. And because Luis is drunk and the way he is, he keeps saying he can't resist telling her good night, Maddie, at the end of the thing. And that ends up, Lenny goes in on a rampage at that point, just shoots him. Mm-hmm. But I love how all of this sort of like innocuous kind of thing, like coming of age story, culminates in these two big last moments where the father dies, and then there is also the question as to whether he really did cross the line with Cicely, or if Cicely was confused or what. I have my own theory about this. If you want to go ahead and get into that, I want to know what you think about this movie first, though. I do want to talk about the ending of this, though.
I was pretty mesmerized by this movie. Those kid actors, the two daughters, as you said, this is their movie, and they really do a solid job, especially the young one. It's a lot to ask a girl that young to convey those kinds of emotions and she does a great job. It's no wonder that she's still got a fabulous career acting. She's got lots of talent. I agree with you that the actress who plays the aunt, I thought stole the movie, and it's not easy to steal a movie from Samuel L. Jackson.
Debbie Morgan, who's been in a lot of things, but you know, not a lot of things that I have seen, and I want to find more of her.
She was great. I've known people like Samuel L. Jackson's character, men that were dogs, but were so charming that even women who knew they were dogs were still drawn to them.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating to watch. And it's also frustrating. I think somebody commented something close to this, that every adult this girl goes to, almost to a person, fails her. Like, nobody gives her very good advice. The aunt is honest when she says, don't ever tell anybody about this. That's no good. But that's still not helpful for the girl who's got this trauma and needs to process it. And like, she goes to her sister, doesn't believe her. Her dad repeatedly lets her down and tries to charm his way out of it by saying, I love my baby girl. And to see her go to the voodoo lady for ultimate help, I think, is a reflection of the fact that she didn't think there was anyone else that could help. But let's see, one or two other things. I felt like the whole movie was cloaked with the hint of incest, and it was very unsettling, and I think it was intentional. And like, there's even a point, not just the Cicely and Samuel L.'s character, but that when Eve is telling Lenny about basically telling him about the affair, the first thing she says is she asks him where the apples are, and he points, he just walked by him, and she turns to go walk at the apples, and he watches her and says, Lord have mercy. And she's 10 fucking years old.
Like, yeah,
there are so many creepy fucking adults in this movie. And again, I think this is the point. I think this is the murkiness of what she's trying to tell. But You kind of understand why Eve makes the decisions she does. There's also this scene where he supposedly hits her after a kiss, and it's questioned who initiated the sexiness of the kiss. But you understand why Eve decides what she decides after what she's been through. She's really trying to protect her sister more than kill her dad. I don't think without Eve and that actress that this movie works very well at all, because most everybody else is, other than her siblings, are kind of terrible. And I think that's supposed to reflect the foundation of this family with the slavery and the 16 babies in the bog and all that. I called it a bog. Let's talk about the ending, though.
Yeah. So at the end, there's a sort of a discussion as to whether, so was Luis going after his own daughter? Was he trying to have sex with his own daughter? Was there a possibility that she brought it on? Both of the narrators are unreliable. There could be a truth in between somewhere. But the thing that struck me from the moment that Cicely comes back from that being away trip is that her hair looks so much like her mother's. At the end of it, she looks almost exactly like her mom. And I get the sense, the way the scene has been presented, is that he's drunk. You can sort of infer a lot of things, like he's hoping that his wife will come and reconcile with him. He wants some sort of comfort, but he's drunk and he's tired. And this girl comes down and he doesn't recognize immediately that it's not his daughter. Now, that may be far-fetched, but I'm putting myself in someone's shoes who's drunk constantly and who is extremely tired and is seeing his daughter with this hair that looks almost like his wife's. And I'm not saying this is going to make this in any way right. don't get it twisted. I just think that there's times I know that there's been times for very minor things when I wake up, I'll look at my phone sometimes and I'll read something and I think it says one thing. Mm-hmm. And then I'll find out later it said something completely different. And I'm like, what, why did I think it was that? So I get the sense that he thought that this is my theory. I think that he thought that was his wife at first. He went in for a kiss. She, as the daughter, went in for a kiss as well, thinking, well, this is what we do. And then it got weird. And then he realized that it wasn't his wife and that it had gone too far and that's what happened. That's what I theorize on this whole thing.
Well, I think the point of the entire movie, the ultimate bottom layer point, is how reliable are our memories. I think that is what the movie wants us to question and talk about. There's a line I wrote that Aunt Moselle says that I think is also a theme of the film. She says, "No one leaves this earth without feeling terrible pain." And I think that is maybe the thesis of the plot of the film. But I think the film, like a Rashomon kind of film, is really trying to make us think about memory.
Well, that's a good comparison. Rashomon, for sure.
Yeah, that was my early double feature, but I cast it aside. It was too obvious. But I think the movie wants you to question what is real in this film and what is not, and wants you to question your own childhood memories. I talk about this with my wife all the time. I remember when I was 5 at Christmas, we were at Grandma and Grandpa's house, and I had a little red truck that I'd gotten as a gift, and I was playing with it on the sidewalk. But there's a picture in a family photo album of me at 5 years old playing with a red truck on the sidewalk at Grandma and Grandpa's at Christmas. Do I remember that? Or does the picture become the memory? I don't know. I can't tell you. I can't tell you anymore. It's 42 years ago. I don't even know. So I think the movie is very deep in that regard and very rich for conversation. I could talk, I could show it to my wife, but I could talk for hours about this movie in terms of what it might be trying to say or what might have happened.
Yeah, I like that. That is definitely one of the big themes of this. What is your memory? What is your actual memory of something? I've thought about that many times. Sometimes it's like even sporting events or whatever. You're like, I remember seeing that back when I was 8 years old. And we're like, did I see that? Or did I just see the highlights and think that I remember? Like there's some World Series highlights from the 80s where I thought for sure I was there, but then I remembered back, like those games were super late. Did I watch the whole thing? Did I watch to that point, like back then? And I don't remember anymore. I don't even have any idea if I was up for those moments anymore. But this one, it really does play a lot with memory and that dynamic of it. We know that the only thing we know by the end of it is that something inappropriate did happen. We don't know what the motivations were or anything like that, but we don't know how it got there. And I think the movie is also maybe slightly telling you it doesn't matter who did what in what situation. Something inappropriate happened. Now we're going to move away from it.
Everybody's traumatized. Yeah.
Yeah. Now we're burying that letter in the river, and we're not going to speak of this again, and we're going to move on with our lives and so on. So, Eve's Bayou, great movie. I was glad to revisit it and bring it to this platform. I hope a lot of you out there watched it and enjoyed it as well. Now we have to ask Jeremy what your double feature for this movie is.
Shh, be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I'm ready. I did lean Rashomon early because she immediately has her memory questioned about what she saw in that barn.
Yeah.
But I do think the movie, to pair with this, has to have more in common than just questioning our memories. And I thought, you know what would be perfect if I hadn't double featured it already, would be the Virgin Suicides.
Ooh.
Because I think what I really want to go for here is a dysfunctional family, childhood trauma. I'm going to stay away from the incest and the cheating. And listen, I've got two, but I'm going to give you an A and a B. B, the one that I almost went with, that I really wanted to go with, but I don't remember it well enough to sell it as a double feature, is Sam Raimi's The Gift.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I thought about The Gift all the way through this.
Because
especially
has,
with the Louisiana setting and everything.
And the fortune telling, and it's got this gothic overtone. So if you're familiar with that movie, you go with that. I have only seen it the one time, and I just remember...
The Gift would be an amazing double feature with us,
I think,
for
it
sure.
Would be a good one. I hope I don't let you down with the one I actually chose. I want to go with American Beauty.
I thought about American Beauty in this as well.
Because there are a lot of the same actions going on. There's cheating. There's a grown man lusting after a too young girl. There's a murder. There's family dysfunction and childhood trauma left and right, especially next door at Wes Bentley's house. And the thing that really sold me on this double feature is their openings. American Beauty opens with, "My name is Lester Burnham. This is my neighborhood. This is my street. This is my life. I'm 42 years old. In less than a year, I'll be dead." And Eve's Bayou opens with narration that says, "The summer I killed my father, I was 10 years old."
Yeah.
And I think that sold me on those two being a nice married double feature. There's a lot more to laugh at in American Beauty than there is in Eve's Bayou. But thematically, I think there's a lot of discussion overlap between those two movies.
American Beauty has a lot of, like, maybe not memory perceptions, but just what our eyes see, especially with the Chris Cooper character. But Chris Cooper is constantly seeing things out of context. Like, of course, the craziest one is the stupid window with all the perfect blocking so that it looks like his kid is blowing Kevin Spacey in that garage. But just the idea of what we perceive when we see certain actions and things like that, that movie does really well. I like American Beauty a lot. I may like The Gift better, but I think American Beauty is a solid double feature with us.
Well, and if I had had time to watch The Gift and just make certain, I just didn't have the memory. And you've confirmed it. Some people in the chat have confirmed that that's a good pick. So you guys just consider that a triple feature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go. Absolutely. Can't go wrong with any of those movies. They're all good. Okay, so what is next week's homework, Jeremy?
Next week's homework, kids, is a movie I saw in the theater when it came out. I believe I built the print, and I had not seen again until 2 years ago. It's a Russell Crowe starring 2003 movie, Master and Commander, Far Side of the World. Have you seen this, Chris?
I have. I saw it. I was at Hollywood 27 when this movie came out. I saw it then. I did not like it. And what is interesting, though, the last time I saw it was 20 years ago. It has developed a tremendous following since it came out. I don't think it did well at the box office.
Nope.
And it has developed this tremendous following that I'm like, well, maybe I should give this another chance. And I'm very glad a couple weeks ago when you had the Inspector General or Master and Commander, I went ahead and ordered this on Blu-ray so I would have it. And so I'm looking forward to revisiting this movie. It's Peter Weir, but this movie in my head was so average when I first watched it that I thought it was Ron Howard.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow.
And I hate bringing that up about Ron Howard, because I tend to like Ron Howard. It's just that a lot of the movies that he makes are like, you know, oh, well, that was okay.
Yeah.
I want to see it.
This is on HBO Max. It is a Napoleon era naval drama. I think there's some Hunt for Red October level tactical shenanigans in this movie that are really enjoyable. The heart of the movie is the friendship between Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany. Paul Bettany is the ship's surgeon. He's also a naturalist and has sort of a disgraced physician past. And he's trying to catch this legendary enemy ship. I'll let you find out whether or not he does and what happens along the way. I hope that you don't dislike it. It is an 85 on Rotten Tomatoes, so my hopes are high. And it's a 7.4 on IMDb, which is higher than normal. So that's your homework for next week. It's Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
And I'll tell you right now that this is another one of those movies that could have been very much colored by my working situation. Because if I was watching this movie at on a midnight or something like that, and I think it's a 2.5 hours. It's one of those kind of, it's like around 2.5, I think. If I watch this movie late at night, then I may have just been like just tired watching this thing and didn't give it its full due. So looking forward to watching it refreshed and 20 years later. And I can't wait to watch it again. So
awesome. Sweetness.
All right. And, do we have any time for some questions?
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
David asked pumpkins. Okay. What is one weird fact you learned from a movie? Example, beyond the Poseidon adventure, Michael Caine is a deep sea wreckage scavenger. And when other people showed up at the site of the Poseidon, he shouted, "This is my site. By law, all of it belongs to me." And I turned to my dad and asked, "That can't be all he needed to do." And my dad said, "Yes, that's all he needed to do." That's a very specific fact, but I love it.
Okay, so even though I think this fact has some caveats to it, there's a completely and wholly unnecessary conversation at the end of Crimson Tide, where Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington are waiting to get their proper orders, and Gene Hackman has to make it a racist thing. I don't know why. It makes no sense whatsoever why they bring up the white and black in this, but he's like, "Have you ever heard of the Lippensotter stallions? He's like, "They're all white." And he says they're from Spain, but they're actually from Portugal or something. Like, I don't know what it is. And Denzel Washington's like, "Yes, sir." And Gene Hackman's like, "Yes, sir. You realize that they came from Portugal?" Or, "Yes, sir. You realize that they're all white," or whatever. And then Denzel Washington has to tell them that at birth, Lippensotter stallions were born black. And, you know, it's one of these, you have to feel like Quentin Tarantino's rewrite was one of the things that he wrote into the movie. Just an interesting tidbit about Lippensotter stallions, which I did not know. And I dutifully went to check what was being said about them in there. And of course, there are some caveats in all of this. Like, it's not as basic as it is in this piece of dialogue. But I didn't know that. And there you go. That's a weird fact that I got that has stuck with me.
I've always felt like the three most obvious Tarantino touch-ups in that movie were that scene, the Silver Surfer conversation, sure. Get the radio fix like Scotty from Star Trek.
Definitely.
Those are all excellent parts of the movie, so I'm not upset that he touched that script. My answer is from Molly's Game. I think is a little bit of an underrated film. It's not the best. It drags in a few places, but man, she's good at that Sorkin-esque dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells a story early on. She's trying to convey that her two older brothers are championship athletes and had higher grade point averages than her, even though she had a 4.0 and is a championship athlete. And she said, "In any other room, I'm a star, except in my own family. But the story she tells is about Matthew Robinson, a runner at the Olympics who shattered the world record, but came in second to Jesse Owens. Mm. And then it turned out that Matthew Robinson's brother was Jackie Robinson. And I never knew that story. I looked it up. It's true. I think it's fascinating. I would imagine being that guy. Like, I broke the record too, but nobody remembers my name. It's like Seinfeld tells this joke in one of his old stand-up routines where he's talking about racing and he's like, nobody ever remembers who comes in second. And he does this thing with his head. He was like, hero of everybody? Don't remember who it was. Like, he just moves his head a half an inch. I forget the joke. I botched it. But anyway, love that story from Molly's Game. I think we have time for another, but are there any answers here in the chat we need to shout out?
Let's see. Well, yeah, Finn Harris is like how Kirby Silver Surfer is the only true Silver Surfer. Yep, that's a fact. Dave says Broken Arrow taught me that underground nuclear explosions fuse the sand around the blast so radiation doesn't leak out, or something like that. No need to verify. Jets Met says, day after tomorrow is how I learned that global warming can do in a matter of days, and windy stoves can keep you warm when it's negative 67 outside. So people are coming up with some very true facts from the movies. Finn Harrison says my favorite random fact was from The Big Short. Every 1% unemployment goes up, 50,000 people die. I think Brad Pitt says that in the movie. Good stuff.
All right. We got time for one more.
All right.
What is a movie lie that you believed for too long and it blew you away when you learned the truth? The example here is when I was 10, my sister told me how clever it was that Lieutenant Dan and Forrest Gump was a legless actor and how they hid it for the first part of the film. I rewatched it, and sure enough, you never see his legs, so I figured they were hiding his prosthetics. I was well into my 20s when I learned that the actor does, in fact, have legs.
I don't know if I have anything like that, but there were long rumors that in the movie Don't Look Now that Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie actually had sex in their sex scenes. This was sort of a thing that I didn't realize where the rumor came from. I just assumed that people on set started murmuring about the sex scenes and how it looked too close to it and everything. Of course, you watch Don't Look Now, it's not like the sex scenes in those movies are like, wow, that's hot. You know, it's not like you're looking at it that way. So it's not really what's on screen. But I think that the truth of the matter is that a producer of the movie walked on set and saw some of this getting shot. And this was, I think, before the days of closed set. So, like, people would have the sex scenes, you know, in front of everybody who wanted to come along and watch it, I think is pretty much what it came down to. Maybe there were some closed sets back in the day. I don't know. But the producer came by and saw what was going on, and he swore up and down that Donald Sutherland was actually having sex with Julie Christie, but he's the only person out of that entire group that that thought that was what was happening. And then I don't know if you remember when Eyes Wide Shut was getting shot. There were a lot of rumors about what that movie was even about. And then there were, you know, people who were leaving the production. And I think the IMDb trivia even had this listed at one point. I don't think it does now, but it said because, like, Harvey Keitel was supposed to be in this movie. And it said there was a scene where Harvey Keitel got so aroused, they had to kick him off the set because he was being a menace of some sort. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's fucked up. And then you find out later, he just had scheduling conflicts. He couldn't finish the movie because it was running too long. That's it. And there's really nothing in the filming of Eyes Wide Shut that would make you think that somebody would have an erection and just could, you know, because there's a lot of nudity in Eyes Wide Shut. I wouldn't say there's much sexy going on in Eyes Wide Shut.
Right. No, I agree.
There's not much in there. So, like, you know, it's not one of those type of movies. So, yeah, I think the Harvey Keitel thing blew my mind more than any of them because it felt like back in the day that felt like such a true story for some reason. Of course, now if I hear something like that, I'm like, okay, can I get some other sources to corroborate that, please? And whatever. So yeah, there you go.
I have a very boring answer to this question, but I grew up, we didn't have cable and I wasn't for the most part allowed to go to movies. My dad watched a lot of Perry Mason and Matlock. Mm-hmm. And then I snuck away to see A Few Good Men when I was late in high school. And I did not realize that trials were boring as fuck in real life until I think maybe the OJ trial, where they aired so much of that, or at least played so much of it on the news. There was, I remember feeling like, let's do something already. Let's go. Like, let's, and even the OJ show that came along behind it made it a TV trial instead of, you know, it's just, and then I, not too long after that, I wrote that the William Kennedy Smith trial was on. He was on trial for rape, I believe. Infamously, they covered up somebody's face in that trial with a dot on screen. But I remember thinking, this is goddamn boring. Like, well, I understand a movie can't be boring, but they basically completely rewrote how the legal profession works for movies. And it's just wild to me.
Over in the chat, Jet Smith says, thanks to Back to the Future, I thought all DeLoreans looked like the time machine. Josh Zero says that Hitchcock's Rope was a one-shot, didn't learn about hidden cuts until maybe 5 years ago. Yeah, when I first watched Rope, I thought that it was done all in one shot as well. But then I think I heard about the hidden cuts pretty early on into that, but like I was still unclear on the concept that he was going up on to the back of somebody's jacket or something and then cutting back to the jacket and then coming back out so that it would look like it was one seamless cut. That is an interesting one. James says, I'm always bummed to learn that a striking piece of film music is ripping off another classical piece. Craig Armstrong ripped off John Adams' Chairman Dances for Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby. And and you'll see that with Baz Luhrmann movies a lot. Baz Luhrmann does that quite a bit. All right. Well, that's going to do it, I think, for this this episode. And once again, thank you guys for coming out and commenting on Twitch and YouTube today. We appreciate you coming out and watching us talk some movies every week. We appreciate that.
Yep.
Next week is going to be Master and Commander. Can't wait to revisit that. And so that's going to be it, guys. We'll see.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. Beef jerky is amazing.
I might have told you this, but there's a new golf game coming in, I think, March or April. It's EA Sports hasn't made a golf game for a few years, but they're making one this year, and it's called PGA Tour 2023. But you can play the Masters.
Yeah, you put this on Slack. We were talking about that.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm gonna do that with Ian on Twitch.
Oh, that'll be sweet.
Play some golf together, and stream and maybe do it semi-regularly.
That'll be fun.
So I think that'll be really fun.
I'd love to tune into that one.
Well, yeah, and you can always, maybe we'll have a third person join us every now and then, or I mean, I'm sure you can play up to four or more people.
Oh, sure. Do you have to know how to play real golf to be able to play this golf?
No. No, I mean, you know enough. First of all, you've played a round of golf. You know enough about golf if you've just seen some of it on TV to be able to play the video game. And it'll make you think you're awesome at golf.
I imagine it's probably a little bit different from, like, I haven't played a lot of video game sports since the early 90s. And I remember, like, when you would play basketball on the Sega Genesis or whatever, and you made a shot, when you took a shot, there would be one thing for the power and one for the accuracy. So if you got it in within the one part, in the other part, you usually got the shot down. I imagine things have gotten a little bit more complex since then.
I don't think so. The last golf game I played was a 2K game, and it was 2K21, I think. And that was basically pull down on the left stick for backswing, go straight up on the left stick for swing through, and that determined like how fast you did it, determined the club head speed, and of course it's easy to miss and get a little off center, and that determined, you know, the accuracy of how far the ball goes. But once you sort of master that, which only took me a few months.
Yeah, the awesome thing that I want to see about this Masters game is how detailed it's going to be, because they apparently have some technology that makes it like down to the plant.
Yes.
And they're going
to Augusta gave them access to their, it's got some awesome name like horticultural database or something. So that, yeah. And then they also used that same technology that self-driving cars use, like, not LED, but something with an L. That is super advanced tech. So yes, it should be, and the graphics at this stage should be pretty exquisite as well. So it should be down to the plant, which is wild. I bet people who go there every single year don't know down to the plant what it looks like. But having been once for 2 days, I'm excited to see that course. Now, you've been able to play the Masters course apparently on a couple of previous golf games.
Yep.
But the graphics weren't as good. gameplay wasn't as, it was, they, the Masters has always been reluctant to license their course to like the big dogs, but this year they are. And, but also in addition to that, you can play all four courses that they're going to play the majors on in 2023 in real life. Mm-hmm. So those courses are on this game, and you can play, the Florida course with the Island Green at the TPC Sawgrass, I think is the name of the course. Scottsdale, no, Sawgrass. Anyway, it's the Players' Championship. I'm excited.
Yeah. Isn't there a hole that they're changing? They're going to be changing?
Yes. Yes, and I don't actually know if that's going to be in the game. It probably will be. They are lengthening 13, which is where I spent most of my time when I went. It's the big dog leg to the left, with the pine trees on both sides. It's a par five. And the way that the game has gotten, everybody can drive 320, 330. And so birdies and eagles happen a lot. If I saw Tiger Woods make an eagle on that.
Nice.
They're pulling back the tee by about, I don't know, 50 or 60 yards. There's actually a Twitter account that uses a satellite somehow, and takes images of Augusta National every year to show what the changes are. And so it'll be a longer hole, but it should still be reachable in two for the big hitters. But I'm curious to see how that changes things. I appreciate that while it has got all this history, that they are willing to change to adapt to what the game has become. It's a hard-ass course, even without lengthening 13 and doing other stuff. So fucking hilly, I don't know if it comes off on television. Almost every tournament has shot tracers now that are using laser technology. So you'll see the player swing, and you'll see the ball go off, and a second later you'll see like a red line that basically traces where the ball is going, and they don't cut to that second angle as quickly anymore. When they cut, you still don't necessarily know where you are, because it's always like a side shot of a fairway. But the tracers going off the tee are pretty common now and seem to be pretty accurate. Because when the tracer goes wildly off to the left, you'll see the golfer put his arm out and his club out to the left. And then the coolest tech that I saw was at the Players that I was just telling you about, and it is TPC Sawgrass. I looked it up. They have that Island Green, and it's a terribly hard par three because of the way the stadium seating and the trees create this chaotic wind zone over where the ball has to go up and through. And they came up with this live animated way of showing you the wind patterns as people were teeing off. And you could see the ball go up into that shit and then just go crazy.
Oh, really?
It's not a hard hole because it's an Island Green. It's a hard hole because the winds are insane, and mm-hmm. you really don't necessarily know what you're going to get when you throw that ball up there. But that's the last time at golf technology. Like, I went in the other room and told my wife about it. I thought it was such cool technology. The cool thing about the Masters is they have all these traditions that people just simply don't break. So if you have a canvas fold-out chair you're going to sit in, you get in the morning and you can walk to anywhere on the course that spectators are allowed and put that chair there and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And no one will move it and no one will sit in it.
Mm.
And so we did that and set those chairs right at the bend on 13. And then Tiger hadn't teed off or anything yet, so we went over to... I cared about Tiger. I don't know if my dad and my brother did. Mm-hmm. So we went over to 5 and sat in the bleachers and ate a couple of ham sandwiches and spent a couple hours watching the guys come up and play number 5. And then we went and spent the rest of the day at 13 watching all the big names come through and play that par 5.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are people. Actually, to be fair, once Tiger came through and made that eagle, I did jump over to the other fairway. This is where I got in trouble. followed him all the way through 16, that little par 3, and then I went back to 13 with my brother and my dad.
So you didn't follow him all the way to the last hole then?
I didn't, no, because he was not in contention, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see him get an eagle, and I did. And then on the next shot, I was maybe 10 feet away from him.
Really?
That was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was good enough for me. But at that point, we were watching Jordan Spieth, who ultimately went wire to wire and was young and hadn't won a major yet.
Yeah.
And everybody was buzzing about him. And so we wanted to make sure we got back to see his group come through.
There was a window there where Tiger was in that Masters, like a tiny window, right? Like,
oh yeah,
a little bit. There was some palpable excitement that he might be, but he had just come back, right? That was like his comeback Masters
after the car accident wife stuff. I think so. Yeah, now this is 2015, and he ends up winning in 2019, and he may never do that again. But
yeah.
You should go. We should go.
Yeah, I would love to.
I sign up every year for the lottery for tickets, but I never win.
Except the one time.